This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Tracks of Life, episode 3.
We have made it.
We got
3 weeks, bro. I feel so corny doing that.
I know, right?
Who we got this week, man? Who we got?
We got a good one.
Yeah?
I'm quite familiar with the gentleman.
You know him.
I did.
How long would you say you know him?
All of me.
Okay, all of you from beginning.
Yeah, exactly. It's my dad.
Dr. Phil.
It is.
You know, I never know what to call him when he's around, Jordan. It's like... Mr. McGraw, Dr. Phil, Pops.
You know what? Pump the brakes, because Fabian, I can tell you one thing. It isn't Mr.
Amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
We learned some good stuff about him. Yeah, I learned some things I didn't know, which is, you know, always fun.
Man, he's been through a lot.
Yeah.
He's a tough dude.
Yeah.
Wow, man. Unbelievable. It made me respect him a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Not me.
Man. No, huh? No?
I can't tell him that. His head. Yeah, he's got a big enough head already.
We'll edit that. Don't worry about it.
All right, let's just get to it.
Tracks of Life, man.
Episode 3. Follow along on the playlist. A lot of good songs. Check it out.
Boom.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the... get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The first page of a book never tells the full story. And those news alerts and headlines, like the ones we get on our phones, don't even scratch the surface of what the story is really all about. Stories are like people, multi-layered and complex. It takes some digging to find the truth, but when we find it, it can change our world. We like to dig. The news on Merritt Street. Essential television.
I should make a public service announcement, though, that you can't play the fucking radio or clap on beat or sing.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
I can play a radio if it's got a big on-off knob.
Sure. Yeah, and presets.
Yeah, presets.
That
yeah.
Somebody has to set for it. You can't preset it.
Yeah.
No, I can't. Well, I can't ever get them. I can preset them, but they don't ever call up the same station every time in a row.
I think they call it not working.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, as much as you joke about that, the fact of the matter is, in high school, I made my living by recording music, making mixtapes for people, and installing stereos and speakers in their cars.
Come on.
No, that's what I did.
Mixtape. He was the mixtape
guy?
Yeah. No, I was. And, of course, that was stealing music, I guess.
Right.
And back then, nobody ever brought that up.
Right.
Nobody ever thought about that. But... I had a Fisher reel-to-reel tape recorder, and that was when FM radio first came into being.
Okay.
So what I would do is at night when they had FM, the DJ would say like 5 words all night because he'd be like really cool. He'd say, yeah, this is Bob Collins and we're playing music. And he'd turn it on and he wouldn't say anything until like 6 a.m.
Uh-huh.
And they would play a song, so I would just hit record. And it would play all these songs through the night. Then you'd have every song.
Sure.
And then so I'd get people and they'd give me a list of what they wanted. And I would take that and play it onto a first 4-track. And then it became 8-track.
Wow.
With 4-track, you had 2 choices. You had A and B. And with 8-track, you had four choices.
Right.
And so I would make them 4-track and 8-track tapes and sell it to them.
4-track for $5 and 8-track for $8?
I got like $5-$10, depending on what it was. And then they would also come and say, okay, I want a stereo in my car. So I would go buy like a Pioneer 8-track or 4-track and put it in their car and install the speakers and run the wires under the door thresholds and everything. I was the install guy.
Who knew?
Yeah.
I didn't know. That's crazy.
I
wouldn't trust you to touch my stereo now, though. That's for sure.
And like, that's when Mustangs came out.
Yeah.
The Ford Mustang, like 65s. And in the back, Mustangs didn't have a frame under them at all. They were just sitting on four wheels. People didn't know that. But in the back seat, it was just a piece of metal across the back. There was no like padding or anything. It was just a piece of metal. So I had to get a drill that was like 5 inches around, actually 5 1/4, and would have to drill a 5 1/4-inch hole through steel.
Through steel to put the speaker.
So I could put the speaker in there. But once you had that bitch in there.
Yeah, it was on.
It was in. Yeah. You could put a big magnet with a lot of bass in there. Yeah. So I'd put one on each side.
Who knew? This is wild, man.
It had huge magnets. That thing would just vibrate. You run out of gas, you could just turn up the bass and vibrate home.
So you single-handedly ruined like 100 classic cars.
Exactly.
But let me tell you, they never had to replace a speaker.
Yeah, for sure. And then you gave them something to play on the speaker.
Did you know at the time that like 65 Mustangs would be like the shit in the future?
No idea, but I will say this. When it came out, everybody knew that was the car.
Yeah.
There was nothing before that that was iconic. And when that came out, a yellow Ford Mustang with black interior, hard top, that was the car. That's the car everybody wanted.
Huh.
Cost about $3,000.
$3,000.
I feel like I could, well, it was probably the same as then, but I couldn't pick one car now that's going to be classic.
No, there's so many now. I mean, there's so many different makes and models. But back then, there was Ford, Chevy, Buick, Oldsmobile. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I guess Ferraris. Like now, I guess,
Rolls Royce. I mean, there's a couple of cars that, like Escalade, defined like those few years. Remember a few years ago, everybody had an Escalade. Well, at least everybody in hip-hop had an Escalade.
Like, like Camaros, they make Camaros to look like that Camaro.
Yeah, exactly.
The Camaros now can't be the classic.
Was that 69, 70? That was the year of the Camaro, right? That was like the hot one, 69, 70,
Yeah, the Firebirds with the big bird on the hood and everything. But yeah, we had Plymouth and Dodge, but I mean, that's pretty. You had 5 or 6 makes and that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's what, 30?
Oh yeah, easy. Yeah. Easy.
They all make fast cars, but they're not.
No, and even back then too, like 150 horsepower was a lot of horsepower. Now it's like, if you don't have 500, you're like, it's nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and we made money racing too, because then if you had a 327, 375 horse, that was a big deal.
That was
a hot shot car. And you could get that in a Chevy Nova 2, which was a small body.
Yeah.
With a lot of horsepower in it. We'd get cheater slicks and put them on the back. Anything you could get under the wheel wells and go out and drag race for money.
With the mixtapes playing.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, some girls would want like, they'd want a tape with like the same song. I want a tape with Leader of the Pack 19 times.
because it's not like now. Because listen, I'm guilty of listening to the same few songs. So it's kind of like, now you could just hit back.
We have repeat.
But then they'd have to rewind it.
That's kind of awesome, though. We should just put CDs out now with one song on them.
One song over and over. Yeah. Exactly.
It's
30
like
minutes.
Kanye thing.
Yeah, we didn't have any repeat then, so you just had to put it on there 10 times.
Wow.
Yeah. What was your song?
What?
What was your song? See that transition?
Yeah, I heard that transition. Well, you have to understand, I have to explain this so it doesn't just seem like I'm schizophrenic. You have to understand, I lived during one of the biggest transitions in music in history, because during the 60s, so this is during the time I was in school, in the first part of the 60s up until probably, maybe mid-66, it was pretty much doo-wop and that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden, people discovered grass. Mm-hmm. And it switched. Then all of a sudden you had Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, Steppenwolf, Led Zeppelin.
Man.
So you went from Lovin' Spoonful playing, you know, really, Do You Believe in Magic,
right,
to Steppenwolf, Magic Carpet Ride, and Led Zeppelin. All of these, so, I mean, music made a huge change.
Sure.
So when you talk about the 60s, you went from Motown to Led Zeppelin in like 6 months.
Right.
Huge change. Overnight.
That's cool.
That was probably amazing to experience.
It really was a big deal because you'd have some radio stations playing early 60s and some playing, you know, current or late 60s. And it was like, what happened?
Yeah. Wow. That was probably really cool, man.
Yeah, I know, right? Huge deal.
Because my father was a singer, doo-wop. So I'm real familiar. And then like, and you're right, because then you go into the next thing and there's like all these different bands. But then the doo-wop guys, it's very...
I wish I could have seen a doo-wop concert. Just the like choreographed dance moves and the...
They still do it. I'll bring you. We'll go. But not, it's different, you know, now they can all barely move, but they're still doing it.
Yeah, there was also a change in audiences, because if you look back in Buddy Holly and even the early days of the Four Seasons and all, people were sitting in auditorium seats at concerts. It'd be like a gym at Assembly where there was auditorium seats and people were sitting in the seats, and maybe occasionally they would stand up and clap.
Yeah, but that was it.
Right.
But that was it.
Yeah, you're there to listen. You're sitting down. It's very...
Yeah, I mean, you're there. There's...
Yeah, great. Thanks. Next song. Next selection. Like next selection.
Yeah. Next band, please. Yeah.
And that was it.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden, people discover grass and the music changes. And now they started having the concerts outside.
Uh-huh.
And people were like camping out overnight, and they were staying there, and bands were playing for 6 hours, stuff like that.
Imagine.
And Iron Butterfly comes along with Inagata De Vita, and it lasts for like 2 hours in one song they're playing, and you know people are like taking their clothes off and running around, and these are the same people that were sitting in those auditorium chairs 6 months ago. And their parents are freaking. They're like, what the hell happened? You know, somebody put something in the water?
Right. Kinda. Yeah. And the answer is yes.
Yes,
right?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why everybody says, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
Yeah, get it. So anyway, back to your song.
Well, you want songs that I'd define for me what you want, and your listeners probably need to hear this occasionally anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think our mission statement kind of thing, whatever you want to call it. It wasn't a memo, it was a mission statement.
Mission statement. That's our mission.
Yeah. We had the conversation that we wanted to have with people at dinner one night, which was basically just the songs that you make memories out of, or that the songs that are the soundtrack to the memories you made. Because you can be in a car and hear a song, and all of a sudden there's four people in the car that aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
The smell's different. The weather's different. Yeah.
So it's the moment, or you know, maybe something that made you like
your defining moments.
Your defining moments.
The soundtrack to your defining moments.
Yeah, that's very funny.
Like when you first wanted to do yoga, you know, things of that nature.
Now, a big one for me, I have to tell you, and there's a story that goes along with it, and you have to understand, for me, music is really an emotional thing, because I was listening to you guys talking about your podcast before it came out, and you were talking about how emotion travels in time, and that's really true. You know, you can forget things intellectually, but when you hear music, it does cause you to emote, and that takes you back to a time. And one of the songs for me was For What It's Worth by Buffalo Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
And that song, everybody knows. I mean, you hear the first note of that song, everybody can, you know, it's like, name that tune. Yeah. One note, you can name that tune.
Totally.
And
we call that a crowd goes woo moment.
Yeah.
When we're writing. You hear one note and then the crowd goes woo.
I don't call it that, but yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. And
hip hop guys don't say that.
No, that's not a thing.
That song, the publication says it came out in February of 67. It actually came out in December of 66, I think. But at the time, I was a junior in high school, and this was a time that, you know, sadly, we were having a lot of racial tension in Kansas City, where I was going to high school at the time. And I was working in downtown Kansas City at night. I worked at Hallmark Cards from 4 to midnight shift. Mm-hmm. And
what the hell did you do at Hallmark Cards?
At Hallmark Cards, my job, they were really big into human resources at the time, so they were have us come in and give us all these tests, and then they would match the job to our personality. And my job was to tear shit up.
So that says a lot about your personality test.
Yeah, exactly. They gave me...
It says a lot about my childhood.
Yeah. It's one of the things where they give you an IQ test, you look up and everybody's looking around the corner.
Right.
He's the guy third from the left. And my job was to take a 3-pound sledgehammer, and they print the Hallmark cards from what they call dies. They're these real hard things that they put in a printing press, and then they run paper through there and print the cards mm-hmm. off of these dies. And they said, okay, your job is going to be to break these things up. And because people were stealing them and bootlegging cards, they would steal the die, and then they would go run the cards and sell them for half price.
Bootleg Hallmark cards.
Yeah, exactly. And they would sell them for half price. So they said, we have to destroy these things so people can't steal them. And I thought, God, how many can they have? I mean, really? It's going to be my job? They had like 5 warehouses, a block each size, floor to ceiling of these things stacked up.
Wow.
They were about the size of a 5x8 card.
Wow.
And so I had to put them on the corner of a dumpster and hit them with a 3-pound sledgehammer to break them.
So that was your job?
That was my job.
4 to midnight.
Yeah. And they said, we're going to put you in a warehouse by yourself, because it's really noisy and you're not going to have any supervision. So you're mature enough to work without supervision, aren't you? And I'm
of course.
I can't believe you even asked me that.
The guy you're giving a sledgehammer to? Of course.
I can't believe you even asked me that.
So 4 till midnight by yourself.
With a sledgehammer. With a sledgehammer. In an empty warehouse.
Yeah. So the guy's gone like 5 minutes. I had a buddy come down. We start building a hot rod. So we'd load the trunk up with these dies and haul them off and throw them in gutters and everything so they couldn't tell how many we broke.
Exactly.
So anyway, we get off at midnight and they're rioting in the streets in Kansas City. And so we can't leave.
Mm-hmm.
They're having fires. They're starting fires or reporting fires, both,
mm-hmm.
and calling the firemen. And then when the fire truck pulls up, they'd shoot the firemen off the trucks.
Jeez,
wow. It was horrible.
So it wasn't safe to be in the streets at all.
No. Yeah. So we get off at midnight. So we go up on top of the building watching, because we can't leave. So we get on top of the building and so we're watching all these people in the streets. And I had mixed tapes.
Mm-hmm. That's it. You were the guy.
Yeah.
So I'm playing this tape and we were playing For What It's Worth.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you listen to the lyrics of the song, you know, 1,000 people in the streets.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there playing this song over and over and watching these people running wild in the streets. And I just, that became thematic for me. And, you know, I didn't know at the time that that song was written about the Sunset Strip and a curfew on Sunset Strip.
Uh-huh.
But it became a real war protest song for Vietnam, of course.
Well, sure, yeah.
But we were listening to it, and I remember sitting there because I went to a school that was probably 40% black and 60% other, you mm-hmm. know, Caucasian or other. And, you know, growing up in athletics, you really become colorblind very early.
Mm-hmm. Because you're on a team. Those are your buddies. Everybody's
You're in the trenches. You learn right fast. There's no difference between anybody.
Right, this guy's got your back. I got my back.
I'm sitting there watching this, and it was the first time that I think I really had a social awakening, because I'd really never thought about it before much, because I just grew up in athletics, and we were all the same, and mm-hmm. I never really thought about that.
Right.
And I'm sitting there listening to this song, and it was the first time I really became aware that I had a social responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And and some of the guys that I worked with were from the inner city on the Kansas City, Missouri side, and I lived in Johnson County on the Kansas side, which was, you know, kind of a white suburb. And, you know, we'd sit there and talk about it and, you know, listen to this song playing. And that was really kind of a social awakening for me. And I remember that song. It was kind of a maturity moment for me, a maturity time for me, and I've never forgotten that.
Oh, wow. Because you're looking at the you're listening to the song, but you're experiencing. It's like you're visually seeing the song while you're listening to it. Yeah, and then
And of course, the lyrics were describing something else, but you apply them to your life.
Right, that's what music does in general. Yeah,
everybody finds their own meaning.
Right, it's one of my favorite things about songs is if you have a conversation with somebody about a song that you love, unless it's, you know, a pretty clear shallow meaning, you can usually find about a dozen different meanings for the same song. And you like pick out your favorite part, and that's what defines the whole meaning to you. And then somebody else is like, no, but the chorus.
Right, exactly.
The chorus.
Right, yeah.
No, so that was a big thing for me. And it's funny, even today, I'll hear that song and bang, it takes me back to those nights, because it wasn't just one night. Those nights that we would sit up there wishing we could go home. Mm-hmm. But it became kind of a focus group, kind of a therapy group, kind of a time we would sit there, and because we were from different walks of life. And like I say, some of my buddies were on the other side of those lines. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there talking to them. They had a completely different point of view than I had.
Yeah.
And, is this when you lived with Hell's Angels?
No, this was before that.
Oh, okay. Fabian's like, wait, what?
What did I miss?
Yeah, this is a little bit before that. Yeah.
I'm Quentin Tarantino-ing some of our conversations that might pop up.
So this is now we're talking, this is what, you said 67, 68.
This was 67. This was in like the winter, February, March of 67,
Good Mustangs in that year too,
as well.
Yeah, very good Mustangs in that year.
Fastback.
Exactly. Yeah. He had one.
Yeah.
Recently.
Yeah, I did.
Like this.
Yeah.
Lucille.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Gone in 60 Seconds.
That was Eleanor. But we'll pretend.
Oh, Eleanor.
No, Lucille was a guitar.
Yeah, and the bat from Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lucille.
Eleanor, that's right.
Eleanor, yeah. You had an Eleanor? Yeah.
You used to always play For What It's Worth for me.
Yeah.
Anytime you were using an example of like, what you need here is a strong bass line. Listen to this bass line. And you'd play that song. Yeah. So I'm very familiar with that song, but it's like more of an eye roll for me.
Well, of course.
Because I know.
But still, it's got me. Anybody else would
take it. It's a good eye roll. It's an endearing eye roll.
Is it?
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. Actually, he mentioned the Hell's Angels. That's one of my other songs, which was. He thinks I'm all. He always says, "You know, Dad, your oldies are getting old." one of my really, really big songs came from the end of '69, the beginning of '70, and that's when I was living with the Hell's Angels.
Yeah,
wow.
And the song was "Ramble On" by Led Zeppelin.
Oh. Yeah,
that's a good one.
That is a great song.
I wasn't around for that song, but I mean, I obviously know the song. But if I were to make up a memory, it would be me sitting around a bunch of Hell's Angels. It just has that vibe to it.
Yeah, and that song on the album, the first song on the album, I never remember the exact names of the songs because you just know
you're
the
listening
song
to
so
it,
much.
Yeah.
But it was A Whole Lot of Love, and then Ramble On, the way they did that album, it morphed into that.
You didn't know when the one song ended, the other one started, sure. Yeah,
there wasn't a clear cut between the two, and it seemed like it was not cut right and done wrong, but that became a signature for those two. You couldn't separate them.
That's so cool.
But that was a great, great song.
No, on me. But can wait a minute, hold on. That's great, but what were you doing living with Hell's Angels? Like, what's going on here? Well, how does this come to pass?
Well, see, there was this went on at a time when I was living, you know, by myself at a young age, and I was living in downtown Kansas City, and I was living in an apartment, sort of. It was one room with a Murphy bed. Mm-hmm. And for people that don't know, that's a bed that folds down out of the wall. Yeah. And when you get up, you fold it back up, because if you don't, there's nowhere to stand.
Right. And plus, you don't got to make your bed. You could just put it away.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you're either laying down or standing up. Right. There's nowhere else in there. And there's no kitchen. There's just like a little cubby hole with like a hot plate in it. And then there's a bathroom, and then you're out in the hall. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just all there is. And this is like down at 27th and Bates, if anybody wants to go check out this story, which is downtown Kansas City. And it's just pretty rough. And this is this street was a very rough street. And the Hell's Angels had a couple of these rooms downstairs.
Okay.
And they lived down there, and I think I was kind of like their mascot or whatever. And I mean, there were a lot of drunks and thugs and
it was a wild time.
Muggers and stuff around there. And I was nice to these guys and stuff. They'd have a problem or something. You know, hey, can we plug something in? Yeah, sure. Throw me up. You know, throw it up. I'd plug it in.
I say that like you were nice by choice. Right. I would not say no to those guys. Can we plug this in? Yes, sir.
Yeah.
But you know, I was always talking to them and stuff. And you know, they thought I was some smart kid that lived down there and stuff. And so I'd talk to them a lot and everything. And they just got to like me, and it was like I had my own security force.
Okay.
Nobody would jack with me down there at all.
They would be crazy to. Yeah.
They killed a guy at a Rolling Stones concert.
I mean, seriously, I'd come down here and somebody would be jacking with me on the street, some of these muggers and thieves down there, and all of a sudden, like three of these guys would like seemingly just come out of the hedge and just say, hey, tell it walking, asshole.
And
they just go away. I mean, they were really, my parents were like, I cannot believe you're living in this hellhole down there. And I'm like, trust me, I've never been safer than in my mother's lap.
Wow. Think about that. That's crazy.
It's like the Kansas City version of Goodfellas when the dude delivers the report card and they're like, see this kid?
Yeah.
No mail goes to his house from that school ever again.
In the oven you're going to go. Yeah.
And there was this great restaurant on the corner. You went up to Main Street. At the end of 27th, it was at Main Street. And there was this restaurant that had been there forever. It was this Italian restaurant. And I'd made friends with the guy that owned it or managed it. He was the boss down there. And at the end of the night, he would give me whatever food they had left, which was a lot oftentimes out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
And it would be these big trays, like these banquet trays. And then I'd bring the trays back.
Right.
So I'd go down there and, you know, knock on the door and he'd say, hey, you know, come in. And I'd talk to him and stuff. And he'd give me these big trays of food that I couldn't eat, you know.
Yeah.
So I'd get it and I'd come down there and just set it
up
for
these guys. You don't have a refrigerator big enough to put it in.
No, I didn't have a refrigerator at all.
Yeah, so it's going to go bad. Let's share it with the guys.
The refrigerator was your windowsill. In the winter, you just put it on your windowsill. And so I would go down there and put these big banquet trays of stuff out there with like spaghetti bolognese and lasagna and stuff. And these guys are all chowing down. I mean, they love me, I'm telling you.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, what's not to love, right?
You made mixtapes and were a caterer.
And electrician as well.
And they love that. And so because I did make these tapes and stuff, I had these speakers, and so we'd run the wires down out of the house, and we'd set them up on the sidewalk down there where they're working on their bikes and stuff. So we're playing music down there, and I've got this tape player up there. And so I had this, like I said, Fisher reel-to-reel, so you could play like 6 hours of music with no breaks.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd love it. They'd set these speakers up down there, and we'd play this. And
so the catering's covered, the DJ's covered, everything's good to go.
Down there.
Yeah.
And they loved it. It'd be like all night long because they'd work on their bikes and set up these floodlights and stuff. And I mean, it's loud and drinking and fighting.
They worked on their bikes in the rooms, right?
Oh, yeah. They'd pull their bikes inside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they'd have doors like this, not fancy like this, but, I mean, and they'd just...
And, you'd and who's going to tell them anything?
Yeah, nobody. I'd be in my Murphy bed at like 4:30 in the morning, and I'd hear this... And they're down, and sometimes they'd be down there burning out on the floor down and stuff.
How many other people lived in the building?
There were probably 15, 20 people in the building. And it's like...
Did everybody get along?
Oh, no. No.
But nobody said anything.
No.
Nobody said anything. You got to go to sleep at some point, right?
Yeah, nobody said anything. There was a lot of attrition in that building. People move in, move out.
Wow.
Like, no, there's no trains go by, no traffic, nothing. You'll be fine. You get in.
If they came to look at the room at like 3 in the afternoon, it was great. Because they were all asleep or gone.
Right.
They come back at 11 o'clock at night, it's like, what the hell? What? Is this the same place I rented this afternoon?
Wow. So Zeppelin, that was the soundtrack... That's what was coming out of this. That brings you back there.
Yeah, it does, boy. Because in the springtime in Kansas City, you know, from like April all the way through October, it's really nice in the evenings out. You know, we'd be out and speakers out and food and stuff, hanging out, playing. Yeah. It was great.
Hey, it sounds like a good time to me, man.
It was a good time.
When we moved here, too. You know the story of Led Zeppelin in the Chateau Marmont?
No.
They're the guys that, speaking of Harleys, they rode their Harleys up the stairs of the Chateau and into the lobby.
Oh, wow.
And parked them. They used to, and they tried to kick them out once, and they were like, nah.
It's not happening.
Yeah.
Wow.
Nobody does rock star shit like that anymore.
No, I mean, they think they do, but.
No. Driving your Harley into a fucking hotel that's on the second story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a pretty good climb there to drive a Harley
it's
up.
It's steep.
Yeah, you got to want to get up those steps on a Harley.
We're going to try it. Really fucked up.
I know a couple guys that can do it.
You don't want to be iffy about that. Halfway up.
Yeah.
That Harley's 750 pounds.
Yeah. If you stop, you start going backwards. You got a problem.
Yeah.
You got a big problem.
Yeah. Just take the elevator.
Yeah. Trust me. Yeah. I know.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that.
Yeah.
Heard about that. A little motorcycle.
My motorcycle keys are buried somewhere on the property. So I get to ask each of you one song, like what was, you had to define this along the way. What was one of your favorite songs?
All right. Well, there was a song, Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Really?
Yeah. And I'll tell you why.
Seriously? Nirvana?
Yeah.
Never have guessed that you were going to pick Nirvana.
But let me tell you.
We're
talking about, it's not quite a favorite song, but it was like a defining moment in my life was this song.
Well, that's what I meant. A song that
cause I was,
wrote on the slate of who you are.
Yeah. Well, see, I always listened to rap music growing up. So it was always like a thing. And I would be on the bus going to school and I had my headphones on. All the kids had their headphones on and stuff. And then, I really liked this song when Nirvana first came out. You know what I mean? I was like, man, it was just because I was into sound more than music because that's just always been my path since I was a kid. I always was into the why things happened, you know what I mean? Versus the actual music of it for a while, you know? So I loved the way that sounded. So to me, it was very exciting to me. But I remember being on the bus and listening to it loud. And I remember the kids were making fun of me. They're like, I remember the kids saying, man, if I was like that, I would kill myself or something like that. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know what I'm saying? Like, what the hell is this guy's problem? So that's not the way I said it. I'm being nice, but, you know, go fuck himself. But it was like, but I was at that, but, you know, we actually got into a fight over it on the bus. I was like, dude, you know, what's your problem? You know, what's your problem? He's like, nah, just, you know, you look like an idiot, this and that, you know, because it was a new sound, you know, that that whole grunge thing was just starting to happen, you know?
Brand new.
Yeah, so we literally got into a fist fight on the bus about it, and I got my ass kicked pretty bad, actually. And then, but I remember my father being like, what the fuck, you know, what the hell happened, you know, what is going on? I was just like, well, no, I'm not going to, you know, the guy's making fun of me. He's giving me a hard time. What am I supposed to do? He's like, no, you're right. He's like, but what, over a fucking song? Like, what is the matter? Like, you're suspended now. What are you doing? So it was, that was a song that kind of made me realize I didn't give a shit. You know what I mean? Like I was a junior in high school. I'm still in I was a sophomore. I'm sorry. And I remember I just didn't give it, like that song was defined that time for me. Because after that, first of all, people in school respected me because this guy was kind of a bully, and I gave him my best, kicked my ass, but I definitely got a couple in there. Yeah, yeah. But after that, I kind of realized, like, I don't give a shit what everybody says. You know what I mean? Like, I still listen to rap music. I listen to doo-wop music because my father's a singer. That's what he did. But I really like this rock stuff. I love the way it sounded. It made me feel good. It was a cool time. You know what I'm saying? So for me, it was kind of like, it kind of made me realize I don't care what this guy thinks, that guy thinks. I enjoy the music of it. You know what I mean? So
what appealed to you about it?
It was more just like, you know, when you look at the guys, I didn't look like any of them. It wasn't like, damn, I want to feel like a rocker. But to me, it was more of like the energy, and also that they didn't give a shit. You know what I mean? It was kind of just like, they're doing what they want. And that song was like, it was loud. It was, you know what I mean? It was a small band, but they made so much noise. You know what I'm saying? It's like, so that's what really appealed to me. That's when I was starting to get into sound too, you know, my career. So I was starting to understand why things did what they did. And that was my initial appeal to, damn, it sounds so cool. It was more of a technical thing. You know what I mean? But then the music, you know, kind of led me, you know, to where I am today. So that was definitely part of it. Yeah. But I remember that vividly, man. That kid kicked my ass so bad. I tried, man.
That's like the perfect soundtrack to getting your ass kicked.
But the best part was too, because it was still playing really loud. And through my headphones, they were on the floor. The kids pounding me out on the bus. Boom, boom, boom. And I could still hear it, actually. Yeah. So it's funny you say that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
What about you, man?
Me? I don't know. I have so many. I think one big one for me that's kind of through a few years, it lasts through a few years, the memories with this song, is it's the Used, A Taste of Ink. It was like their biggest song they ever had. But for me, it was kind of like right when I started playing guitar, or started getting good enough at guitar to play other songs.
Mm-hmm.
And this song, it was just like, it was kind of easy to play, but it was like so hard and so like emotional that everybody that listened to it, you'd have mosh pits like in the parking lot at school when everybody was playing this song out of their trunk or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it just became, they became one of my favorite bands, and I would go see them anytime I could, and I would always watch their videos and their behind the scenes, and they were working with this guy that had discovered him. His name was Craig Aronson. And then they had John Feldman was making the songs. And then Bert was the singer, and he was a fucking maniac. He was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just like, that's the band that I want to be that band when I get good enough to be in a band. And so sure enough, as soon as I started playing with other people, that was one of the first songs that we learned. It was terrible. Like, we could barely make it through the song.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure he heard it like 30 times through the door.
Yep.
But we could barely make it through that song. And when we finally got all the way through, it was like, we did it.
We did it. Crushed it.
Yeah, it was like we made it. And then, you know, fast forward like probably 10 years after that, and I met Craig Aronson, the guy who discovered them, and he turned out to be a huge fan of the band I was in.
Oh, really?
And wanted to help us. And then he hooked us up with John Feldman, who produced and co-wrote that whole album.
Cool.
Who was like super helpful, and like I wrote a song with him and recorded a song with him. And then like 2 months later, we got the call that we got to fucking open an entire tour with the Used.
Wow, dude.
And so I'm like, just like starry-eyed and like jaw dropped, and I've got my backstage pass that says the Used.
Wow.
And I walk into the venue the first day, and I open the door to sound check, and they're playing that song. And it was just like the perfect moment, and I'm just like, oh my god. I had to run back to our bus
because
I was so excited, and so like it just hadn't kicked in yet that I was opening for one of my favorite bands.
Right.
So I ran back to my bus to tell everybody on the bus, like, they're playing Taste of Ink, they're playing Taste of Ink. Nobody else in my band cared as much. They were like, oh, cool, yeah, no, I'll see it later.
Great.
I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And so I run back out of the bus to see more of a sound check, and on the way by, I passed Bert, and he looked at me, and he was like, hey, man, thanks for coming out and doing this. And he, like, said it as a peer, and I was just like, that moment for me was like, oh, my God.
Did you tell him that this is why you play music?
We did later. Like, later on in the tour, he turned out to be one of the nicest, coolest dudes. And we had our trailer down, and it was after we had played, and
before they play, there was a middle band. And so I was just kind of sitting on a road case hanging out, and he was in the back smoking a cigarette, like wandering around. And I was too nervous to say anything to him. You know, I didn't want to bother. I figured he was doing something.
Right.
And he like saw me and like beelined it over to me. And he was like, "Hey man, that show, that fucking rock and roll, man." And I was just like, that's all he had to say.
Yeah.
I was just like, it's enough approval for me. I'm good.
Well, you're like,
Yeah, I was like, I didn't know what to say at that point.
Sure.
Yeah,
for sure. I can imagine.
But from day one, minute one, you've played music for the sake of playing it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, for sure.
It's the passion for the music.
Yeah.
The fun of playing it.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I liked him so much, because he was notorious for going so crazy on stage, you'd have to go in the corner and puke.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which was partially because of the drugs and alcohol. But, you know, he would have so much fun.
He was into it. He was going all in.
We had that conversation, too, where he was like, man, y'all just have fun.
Uh-huh. Wow.
But, yeah.
It's cool, man. That's a great story.
Toured with him twice.
But how would you describe your currency? I mean, some people go into it because they want to be famous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they look at a rock star and say, I want to feel like he looks.
Right.
I want to feel like they behave or they look. And then some people do it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people do it for the artistry. Some people do it for the passion of the music, just how they feel when they do it. There's all kinds of currency, and it's not like one's better than the other. Right. One's right, one's wrong, or whatever. Right. But everybody has a different kind of currency.
Yeah, totally.
You know, what's your current? Why do you do it? What's your currency?
I think at first, because I started learning punk rock songs and Nirvana songs,
mm-hmm.
because they were easy. But I would get into that and watch videos of their shows and listen to the recordings that were supposed to be perfect in other music and had mistakes and stuff in it,
right.
You know, and they would like leave them in there and leave the imperfections. And then you'd watch the videos and they were just having so much fun.
It's part of a feel and it's a vibe.
Yeah. They were having so much fun. And then you could see the direct connection to the amount of fun that they were having,
mm-hmm.
just like shoot into the audience. And the audience would like have their same amount of fun.
Yeah.
Multiplied times 10. And I don't know, there was something about being the reason that people have fun.
Yeah.
That to me was just so cool right off the bat. And not because they looked at you like a party animal or anything, but just to be able to give somebody that excitement that they're wanting so bad to be the vessel for that excitement and the release and the just kind of forgetful 45 minutes to 2 hours, however long you're playing,
mm-hmm.
to me was one of the funnest things that you could imagine doing for other people.
Well, sure.
Because I would go to shows and the same thing would happen. As soon as the lights went off, it was like somebody hit another switch that just like made you tingle, mm-hmm. you know, like just beyond it. Excited is not even a good word.
You might want to get that checked out. You're feeling a tingling?
Yeah. No, but you know, you'd like, anytime the lights go down, it's not just the screaming, it's just like that feeling right. where everybody's like, all of a sudden you're in together.
Yeah.
You got that.
And everybody's there for that purpose, yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, but that's why you've been so successful. That's why you will be so successful, is because it's the exchange. It's that you get high on the music and mm-hmm. and make another people enjoy it. Because if you're there to make other people have a good time,
yeah, if that's your goal and you're doing it, then it's like, that's the most pure form of artistry, I think, that there is. You know what
nobody,
I'm saying?
Yeah. Nobody can have fun if you're not having fun. So to me,
Mike, you have fun.
Yeah, a little bit.
You have fun.
My cue for when a band has kind of run its course growing up has always been when we all stop having fun. Because if you ever go on stage and don't have fun, it's somebody notices.
Yeah.
And then somebody notices that they noticed. And then somebody noticed, you know, it's just, it keeps going.
It's got to be organic.
Well, they do it with me if, like on my show, if I don't want to do a show.
Yeah.
Even though, like, I'll tell a producer, I don't really want to do this. Say, yeah, you do. No, I don't. Yeah, you do. No, I don't. And I do it anyway. I'll go out and give it 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not mail it in. Give it 100%. you look at the message boards, be a thousand messages on there saying he didn't want to do that show.
Yeah, they know. Oh, people feel it.
People are lie detectors. Yeah. It's crazy.
They know it. So why did you decide to do what you're doing? Because you have such a profound impact on the end product, but it's all behind the scenes.
Yeah, you know, that's great, because I was just going to say to Jordan, I learned early on about music and the sound of it, you know, and because my father being a singer, I watched his life, but I also knew I didn't want that. So, but I love music, you know what I mean? So I wanted to be a part of it, but I never wanted to be bothered. I'm kind of a shy, like my friends, that they know I'm a clown, I'm a joking around, I'm always talking, yelling, loudest person in any room, but I'm really shy, you know, like I get embarrassed. So my thing was always, what can I do with music where nobody knows who I am? I don't have to talk to a million people. And by the way, I could sit in a room by myself. You know what I mean? So it's like, that was my path to it. I knew right away that music was something that was going to be part of my life. And I enjoy, because my thing is, when a song, you know, when I mix a record, I could hear a bad, if you go out to a nightclub, a song that's mixed poorly, you could look at the crowd and they can tell. You know what I mean? It's a feel thing. So it's the same type of thing that you were just talking about, Jordan. It's kind of like, I like to move people. I like to make people excitement. You know what I mean? But even further than that, I like to have the artist, I like to accomplish what the artist was trying to do that maybe they can't. I'm looking at myself as an extension. You know what I mean? So like, you know, even one of Jordan's songs, you know, this is what I was trying to do, but it's just, I'm not feeling it so much. Or I love making songs that he might not even like anymore, his favorite. You know what I mean? Like, I really enjoy that like, it gets me high. Like, it's like, you know, I hate this song. Yeah, okay, I'll show you. Boom, boom, boom. And then they hear it and they're like, holy shit, it's amazing. You know, it's like, so that's my input into the song. But at the same time,
I'm not
going to
say which song of mine you just did that with. But he literally just sent one back that I was on the fence about. And he sent it back after blowing your speakers out.
Yeah, that was expensive.
And I was like, I wasn't bullshitting. I told him, I was like, this has just moved up the list. Yeah. Like,
but that's a great feeling.
All 10 spots. Yeah.
And so I chose that path because I really enjoy the music, but I don't want to be a singer. I don't want to play an instrument. I just want to, I want to help people with their art. You know what I mean? So that's been my path.
Yeah, but I would have never even thought of that as a path, as a thing.
Yeah.
Until I heard one of Jordan's songs and then heard the remix of the song. And I liked the song to begin with a lot. And then when I heard it remixed, it was just, it came to a point where there was that punch here, that pop there, that where it just, it like came up off the page, came up off the, off the ground so much more. And it's got to be really satisfying to take something that's really good and make it so much better. David Foster always says, good is the enemy of great.
Yeah.
And that's taking something that's really good and making it great. That's got to feel good to do.
No, it does. Yeah. And thank you. But yeah, no, it does feel good. I enjoy it.
Well, I didn't even know it was a thing until he introduced me to you and I started listening. Because, I mean, I know what mixing is, but I didn't know that it was like a really
crucial part.
Art form where you change signature of a song.
Sure, sure.
I always, when people ask me to describe mixing, and you probably have a better way to describe it, but I always say, like, the recording process is building the room, and then you put all the furniture in there and give it to you, and then you put all the furniture in the right spot.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you don't have a pile of stuff. You've got like a well-organized bedroom.
Oh, listen, a beautiful girl looks even more beautiful when she's got the makeup on, you know what I mean? And she's all dressed up, you know? So that's kind of how I look at it. I'm a beautiful girl maker.
Well, you're like, we should call you Weird Science.
Makeup artist.
Well, if I haven't already, let me completely kill your podcast by giving you some really boring information. There are 26 biosounds in the human body. 26.
Okay.
And so if you have a disease or you're trying to get a return to health, this sound therapies can have a huge impact on how the body responds. And so there are these 26 sounds within the body. that the body really responds to. And we were talking about that the other day with this colleague of mine, Frank Lawless, who is really into this stuff. I mean, he like beats gourds and all kinds of stuff from the Amazon River and talks to shamans.
He's the coolest weird guy in the world.
Yeah, he really is. And I mean, he like goes into hospitals and beats on drums and stuff for, you know, people that are dying, and all of a sudden they get up and jog out of the hospital.
Wow.
I was thinking about you when we were talking about that, because there are certain things in this, you know, this whole spectrum of sound where you hit certain things that just resonate. You just hit them, boom, 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 and they resonate. And if you don't, they don't. I mean, it's just that simple.
Yeah. No, and I definitely, it's funny. I mean, I never, what you're just telling me, I didn't know that that existed, which kind of is embarrassing because this is my life. You know what I mean? But I definitely know certain things do certain things to your body. Like I know certain frequencies, they make your ear vibrate a certain way that brings you, you know what I mean? I know these things, but I'm going to have to look into this.
Well, you know more about it than the people that know about the 26 sounds. You just know about it in an applied way.
Right.
So it makes a huge, huge difference.
Wow. I'm going to look into that, man.
Yeah, I'll send you something about it. It's really cool. I made it boring because I had to be clinical. So I screwed it up for everybody.
It's okay. We'll delete it.
Yeah, we'll delete it. Yeah. Matter of fact, let me delete that.
Yeah.
You can cut that out. So I have one more song if you want. Three. I came with, I came with more than three, but I cut it down to three.
This is all we're doing today.
Yeah.
And my third one actually... has two iterations. It not to bury the lead. It's A Change Is Gonna Come.
Oh wow!
It originally was by Sam Cooke in 1964. Although I didn't discover it until probably a year later. It'd been out for a year, and then Seal recorded it again. Maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and with David Foster, and I was there when he recorded it, and it's one of the coolest music videos ever. And there's nobody in the music video but Seal.
I always make fun of him because he loves the video so much.
Yeah,
it's like his Smells Like Teen Spirit video. He'll play this anytime.
It is
good. I'm not saying it's not good.
It's black and white. It's so simplistic. You know, for me, the definition of an elegant solution is one that is so simplistic that's like got one moving part. You know, Bill Lear that invented the Learjet, his famous saying was, if you don't put it in, it can't break. And, I mean, that's what I think about with the Seal music video. It's
There's no distraction. You're looking at what it is.
You're looking at the Seal.
The lighting is awesome, though.
Yeah, and I think the mix is really good. I'd love to see what you think about the mix.
I'll check it out.
But it's a great version of the song. But
David Foster doesn't have chumps mix his songs, though. So.
No, that's true.
It's pretty on point.
Yeah, I'm sure. Probably sounds very expensive. Yeah. So.
But I heard that song for the first time when we had first moved to Kansas City, and when we first moved there, I have three sisters, Dina, Donna, and Brenda, and I'm the only boy. And we moved from Oklahoma City to Kansas City, but we were broke. And I mean, we were what broke wants to be when it grows up. I mean, no money. And so my dad he had gone back and gotten his PhD, and he had to do an internship at Kansas City General. And they paid $350 a month, and you were not allowed to moonlight.
Oh, wow. So that's it. That's what you had.
That's it. That's all you got. And
so family of five.
Why would they not allow you to moonlight?
There's just the
rules. So you weren't tired or something?
Yeah, because you had to work like 90 hours a week. I mean, all your time was there. And so it comes time to go to Kansas City, and we can't take the whole family. So my mother, who you know as Grandma, and Dina, Donna, and Brenda had to all stay back in Oklahoma City where they were all living together. Mm-hmm. And he had to take me with him to Kansas City because I was getting in a lot of trouble in Oklahoma City, a lot of trouble. And so he said, there's no way I'm leaving you here without a man around, a male around to
kick your ass,
to guide you.
Sure.
Because if you're here with just your mother,
you're going to be wild.
Gonna be gone. Yeah, yeah. I'd already been suspended from all extracurriculars, couldn't play football my freshman season. And so he said, you got to come. So we head to Kansas City. And when we get there, he has to go to the University of Missouri for like a month to complete something. And so I'm in Kansas City and we have nowhere to live.
Wow.
So I'm homeless in Kansas City for the first month we're there. And I mean, just homeless. Mm-hmm. We had a car, but he had to take it with him.
Right.
So I'm just on the street. And when he came back, we were able to get a room at the Y downtown. Mm-hmm. It was for like, it was either $5 a night or $5 a week. I don't remember what it was. But it was not, it wasn't great.
Mm-hmm. It was four walls.
The bathroom was down the hall, and the shower had eight inches of water standing in it. Ugh. I mean, it was just disgusting.
Yeah, everybody else's water.
Yeah.
But I was living on the street, and I'd get up every morning off the street and get a job, and which is why I always tell people, if you want to work, you can work.
Yeah.
But you just get on one end of the street, you just go in the door and say, you need work done today? And they say, well, like what? I say, well, you got a storeroom that needs cleaning out. You need the weeds out of your back parking lot. What do you need? Well, when can you start? Now, right
now. I'm here right now. Let's go.
I'm here. Yeah. And they'd say no. And I'd say, all that stuff stacked up in the back there, you don't need that cleaned up? Well, yeah, I guess you could do that. Okay, so you do that, you get $5. That means you can go get something to eat.
All right, sold. I'm in. Yeah.
And I heard that song play for the first time then. And it really spoke to me.
Sure.
Because, I mean, the first line of the song is, I was born by the river in a little tent. And I was thinking, man, I would love to have a little tent. And But it was a song of hope. A change is going to come.
Yeah.
And I heard that song, and I kept thinking, okay, you know.
Keep pushing.
A change is going to come. Wow. A change is going to come. You just got to. And the, you know, people talk about being homeless and think about, oh, yeah, it's horrible, it's scary, it's this or that. The worst thing about being homeless is it's boring.
You got nothing to do.
The days are long. Yeah. I mean, even if you get a job and you're downtown, the store's closed downtown at 5.
Right.
And then you've got like...
Yeah, the whole rest of it.
16 hours to the next day.
Morning, yeah.
And you get in a fight every day. You don't get in a fight couple times a week. You're going to fight every day because there's somebody that wants your shoes or your jeans.
And you're like, this is all I got.
Somebody's going to come every day.
Wow.
So that song really defined that. And you think about a song like that, you think, oh, that would bring up such bad memories.
Right.
Why would you like that song? It brings up such bad memories. It doesn't bring up bad memories because I look back on that and say, I observed myself get through that just fine.
Yeah.
And so I learned about myself during that time. I thought, you know, hell, I can do that. That's why I've never been afraid of being poor. I can do poor.
Right. You did it.
I can do
poor. It's not the scariest thing in the world.
I've never played the game of life with sweaty palms because I've been poor. Mm-hmm. I can be poor. Uh-huh. I can do that. I know how to do that. So I've never been afraid of it. And so I look back at that. That's not a bad time in my life. That was a...
Interesting time.
Interesting time. Character building time.
That's what I was going to say. It made you who you are. And that song helped you get through that time to who you are. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I got a funny fact about that song. Totally random. That is the most... I found out a few years ago. One of my clients wanted to sample that song.
Oh, yeah.
And it was denied. And the estate
said that's actually, well, the estate that said no, they get requests all the time, but the legal team at the record label said that's actually the most requested song to be sampled.
I believe that.
Really?
Yeah. And it's never gets cleared. So Seal, I mean,
do you know what part of it?
Well, no, just the actual, the change is going to come, the whole, it's been a long time coming, so on, but I know, I think that's, you know, whatever the lyric, I'm probably saying it wrong, but
no, that's,
but that section of it is the most requested
one. I totally believe
and,
that.
And it's denied, you know, constantly. Yeah. You know, they say they never clear it for anybody, so David and Seal obviously have different connections, you know, than the majority.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you're going to let somebody do it, put it in good hands.
Well, yeah, for sure. He definitely did it justice. Absolutely.
Well, they could make a fortune off of that.
Well, yeah, you would think, yeah. For sure.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, but Sam Cooke did a great job with it, but then Sealed killed it. I thought he did a great job with it.
Yeah, Seal's version is awesome.
Well, yeah. Seal's awesome, yeah.
Yeah, so everybody look that up.
Yeah.
So
he said he's got a list of songs.
You got another one you want to share?
It's well, up to you.
I don't know how much time we have.
I wrote down songs that just really stuck with me.
Somebody told me you're a big Kid Rock fan.
I am a big Kid Rock fan. And I know Kid Rock, and he's a really good guy.
Uh-huh.
Bobby.
Yeah.
When I met him, I so badly wanted him to introduce himself as Kid Rock. And all I got was Bob.
Bobby.
Hey, Bob. I'm Bob.
Not Robert.
No.
Bob.
He introduced himself to me as Bob, my brother as Bob, but then Erica is Bobby.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's a rock star, man. What do you want to do?
Yeah, I think he's great. I think he's hugely talented.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's amazing.
I think a lot of people don't realize how talented he is.
Yeah, and he hasn't done a lot lately.
Mm-mm. Picky.
I don't know why, but I wish he would. But, I mean, that one album had like 10 major hits on it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because they just released the greatest hits too, right? So maybe that's a sign that something's coming. I don't know. I hope so.
It's got to be. I'm sure at this point it's just that he doesn't have to do anything unless he really, really loves it.
So, well, I'm more than sure he made plenty of money. He maybe is just perfecting some song.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So, wow. So what else you got on that list of yours over there?
Well, you know, there was an era, I mean, for me, where I was like really going to concerts like you do now. I was going to Jefferson Airplane and Janis Joplin.
Oh, see, I wish... Your list of concerts that you got to go to, your list of concerts that you probably passed up are probably the concerts that I would like kill to go to now.
Like, I went to Janis Joplin.
Exactly.
I mean, probably 4 or 5 times.
Come on.
And sometimes, and I mean, I went to the concerts where it really is true, where she would have a bottle of whiskey on her belt and she was not... she was not inhibited in any way. I mean, she was just raw and passionate. And
Mercedes-Benz was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
What a voice.
Won't you buy me?
It started out being Big Brother and the Holding Company. And then it was Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company. Then it was just Janis Joplin.
Yeah.
I first saw her when it was just Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Oh, wow.
And that was A Little Piece of My Heart was a big, big song.
What a song.
And then that was one of my really kind of life-changing songs. It was at a time where it was really... living and being independent, and then she had a song, Me and Bobby McGee, which was written by Kris Kristofferson.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Kris Kristofferson wrote that song, but she sang it.
Me and my Bobby McGee.
Which has got one of the greatest lyrics in the history of songwriting. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Wow.
That's awesome.
It's one of the best song lyrics ever. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Yeah, that's I mean, wow. Think about that. That's pretty cool.
Windshield wipers slapping time.
I didn't know Kris Kristofferson wrote that.
Yeah, he's a great songwriter. I want to
hear him sing it, too.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's
And
out
he
there.
Has. But you know, that was really, really great. So I loved that kind of music back then. But all right, you've milked my favorite songs, boys. That's all you're getting out of me.
That's it, you're out of here?
Well, thanks for doing it, even though you're kind of biologically required to.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it was really fun to think about this. I think you've got a great concept here for this podcast. I hope you keep doing it.
We will.
We will. Thank you.
I like just sitting around and thinking of my own songs.
Uh-huh. I like confusing people.
Yeah.
Like you had no idea. You're like, why did, did he really say that?
Yeah. You understand that there's a certain, don't turn that off yet.
I'm not just.
He's saving.
You have to understand that there's a certain, there's a certain brotherhood in podcast land. Mm-hmm. I do you, you have to come do me.
Ooh. All right.
We're there.
So I do your podcast, you have to come do mine.
Let's do it.
He might make you cry.
I'll try not to.
Well, I have tax I put in your chair. You sit on tax.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right.
We're in.
We're in.
All right. Thanks for having me, boys.
Thanks for coming.
Bro, that was amazing.
That was good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, he's so cool.
Well, it's weird to say your dad's cool, but after that conversation, he got a little...
He got some points?
Yeah, he got some cool points.
All right, man. This was a fun one, though. Yeah. Definitely, man. Definitely.
Next week, too, though.
Next week's a big one, man.
Yeah, it is. Your boy.
Yeah, Pusha T.
Yeah.
He's an animal.
Yeah, he is.
he's an animal.
He's got a very, like, a very unique way of telling his stories
that
I think everybody's going to love.
Man, it's going to be dope, man. Yeah. Make sure you tune in next week. King Push is in the building.
Boom.
Tracks of Life.